And today I want to look at something slightly different. I want to start the timeline. So I want to look today at the BBC in the 1920s. A whole series of events from the 1920s. I might even get to the beginning of the 30s, you never know. But what I will try to do every time I tell you about an event or a new programme, what I will try to do is to show the links with these big questions. This would fit into this big question, this would fit into this big question, because of course, yeah, the chronology of itself. So, because I do want to do some chronology, and also the good thing about chronology is that it then allows you to fit in, as you know, on the blog, I've given you videos and articles about the 50s and the 30s and the 80s. And your job is to pull them together so that you know, the 60s, okay. I know, here are main events, main things, I've got them. And this is how I like to work. I like to give you a lot of information rather than structure it all for you, because that's boring for me. Okay, so what shall we do? So let me get my wonderful new brand new PowerPoint. Can you see it there? Yeah. Okay, and remember, if you have questions as I go along, isn't that beautiful? If you have questions as we go go along, I didn't want to be a university professor, really. I wanted to be a nursery school teacher. If you have questions as we go along, just put them into the chat, and I will do what we can with it. So the BBC before 1945, well, we have to go back quite a long way to begin with, and we're going to go right back to good old Marconi. Bien sûr, il y a une faute de frappe là, bien sûr, c'est pas Marconi. Marconi in 1901, and this was the gentleman who set things going in many ways. In 1895, he transmitted over half a mile's distance a Morse message. You know, bah, 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 bah. That's how it goes, the Morse message. And this was by radio, not because, of course, they had been doing this for 50 years by telegraph, by wire. That was no big problem. And at the beginning, they didn't call it radio. They called it wireless telegraphy. Wireless telegraphy. So telegrams, but without wires, which was pretty impressive. And yet nobody really thought about broadcasting, because broadcasting, so the idea of one person giving the message and many, 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 many people receiving it. This was something that had not occurred to anybody. And indeed, when they discovered wireless, as Marconi did, the first thing they thought was, oh, well, this will be useful for contacting ships in an emergency or giving information to the military. That is information from one person to one person. So what happened to Marconi? Well, it was interesting because in 1895, he managed to transmit a message in Morse over half a mile, whereas many scientists had said, oh, half a mile is the maximum. Yeah, and that can't be done. Can't be done more than half a mile. And so this is useful because it reminds us that the whole technology was completely new and people were not expecting it. Just like, I love science fiction. And throughout the 1960s and the 1970s and the 1980s, I read hundreds of books on science fiction and none of them imagined the internet. Zero. Because imagining the future is actually harder than you think. Okay, so what happened to Marconi? Well, he didn't get enough support from government in Italy, and so he moved to London in 1896. He was from a fairly elite family, and his mother had brought him up to speak both Italian and English. And he got people interested in the British General Post Office. He got some people interested, and very quickly they could go much, much further than half a mile. This was actually quite complicated. It seems easy now, but in reality it's not. I mean, if we were all on a desert island and we had to build a radio, we wouldn't be very good at it, I don't think. Would you? No, me definitely not. Okay. So in 1898, for the first time, they used this wireless telegraphy to summon help for a ship in distress. There was a ship in danger, and for the first time in 1898, it could contact help and say, come quickly, I'm dying, I'm drowning. 1899, the first radio message from England to France, not voice, Morse code, but without a wire. It was incredible. 1901, the very first radio Morse message from Cornwall to Canada. This was still Marconi, Yeah, Marconi was the big exciting guy, and he was absolutely passionate about this. It appeared to be magic, you know. I say something now, and they know about it in Canada, without a wire. That's pretty incredible. Remember that it was possible to send telegrams to the United States. There was a cable under the Atlantic Ocean, which I think is 1860, approximately, something like that. So by wire, but with the wireless, of course, it's much more impressive. And indeed, in 1912, perhaps you recognise this ship. It used to be prettier. This is the Titanic, the real Titanic on the bottom of the ocean, which they found a few years ago. It was prettier than that originally when they set it up. Good. OK, when the Titanic went down in 1912, it was because of Marconi's wireless telegraphy that they could summon help, and quite a lot of people survived. Welcome, Josephine. Sadly, in other areas of his life, Marconi was less of a hero. He joined Mussolini's fascist party in 1923. Meanwhile, not 1,000 miles from Crewe Junction, meanwhile in Paris, and here we have the Eiffel Tower in 1901. And you know that it's in 1901 because of the airship there. But in fact, what happened here was not in 1901, it was in 1919. And so after the First World War, just after the First World War, and Mr. Eiffel, Gustav, my friend Gustav, he was rather worried because the plan for the Eiffel Tower was to destroy it afterwards. It was set up for the exhibition. And they were going to take it down afterwards, of course. Why would you want an enormous metal structure next to the Seine, you know? And Eiffel was rather worried that his tower was going to be dismantled, and he was looking for ways to show it could be useful. And so with his own money, he paid for experiments to establish a radio wireless telegraphy station at the top. And this is one of the elements which encouraged the authorities to say, okay, you can keep your tower for another 10 years then. And as we know, that from a symbolic point of view, it became extremely important. 1919 is the first private broadcast in Europe. Now, this is a broadcast, so this is something slightly different. Remember, previously we were talking about wireless telegraphy, information going from one place to another single receiver, you know, Cornwall to Canada. This was a broadcast. This was for everybody. Not really that many people, because there were only a few hundred people who had radios, which they probably made themselves. But this was it, the Radio Soirée Musicale, the 6th of November, 1919, in The Hague, in the Netherlands. Their first Soirée Musicale, announced in the newspapers before. And so across, certainly France and England, people who had made a wireless, they hadn't bought it, you couldn't buy them yet, they'd actually made one, or maybe you could buy the first ones, but most people made them, and they could hear this musical thing coming from the Netherlands, and it appeared to be absolutely magic, of course. Well, that's the advert for it. 1921, broadcasting begins from the Eiffel Tower, the first concerts, 1921, Radio Tour Eiffel. And in 1922, then, the British Broadcasting Company is founded. So the British Broadcasting Company, I'm hoping you've had time. Oh, hello, little one. I'm hoping you've had time to understand that we began with a company and then became a corporation later. So, 1922, the British Broadcasting Company is founded, and very shortly afterwards, John Reith is recruited. Notice that John Reith did not invent the British Broadcasting Company. But when they employed him, he was allowed an enormous amount of freedom. So obviously, we need to have some sort of vision of what the 20s were in Britain if we're going to understand what radio did. Now, at the beginning of the 1920s, Britain was still very much suffering from the aftermath of the First World War. The wounded soldiers were finding that they were being less and less treated like heroes, and that government money for pensions was harder and harder to get. The trade unions, which had gained millions of members during the war, they were very powerful during the war because the government didn't want them to go on strike, wanted to win the war. And so the trade unions were stronger than ever, and this was reflected in the rise of the Labour Party. which was set up by, which was established by the trade unions, the Labour Party. Now, since the beginnings of parliamentarianism, the Conservatives and the Liberals have been the two parties dominating. But once most working class men could vote after 1884, the Liberal Party tried to attract some trade union members of parliament. So I said, oh, well, you know, if you tell all your million members to vote for us, well, we could have two trade unionists among the members of parliament. This was the sort of deal that was going on. But it was not so easy for the Liberal Party to do anything for the trade unions because they had other more powerful influences. And so at the very beginning of the 20th century, the Labour Party was formed. Very different from France, Spain, Italy. It's not an accident that it's not called the Socialist Party, because it was a mix of radical Christians, trade union leaders and Marxist activists. A mix. And that was the historical strength of the Labour Party, that it was a mix. And so you never got in Britain, like in France, the two parties of the left. In France for decades and decades, Socialist Party, Communist Party, both quite powerful. In Britain, they all were inside the Labour Party. So, in 1918, women over 30 and all men got the right to vote, and the Labour Party will gradually become the replacement for the Liberal Party. So we will still have a two-party system, but instead of sometimes a Conservative government and sometimes a Liberal government, we'll get sometimes a Conservative government, sometimes a Labour government. And this happens in the 1920s. The very first Labour government was elected in 1924. It only lasted a few months, and as a minority government, found it difficult to do very much, but they did introduce a very important reform in social housing. The election campaign in 1924 again, which defeated the Labour government and which saw the Conservatives win again, was characterised by a very famous fraud that the newspapers announced that they had found a letter from the Russian government minister Zinoviev, calling on British Labour Party members to have a revolution in Britain. And this was one of the important elements which meant that in the elections, people did not vote very much for Labour. However, as perhaps you know, it was a fraud. It was a forged letter written in Germany by somebody else. It did not come from the Russian government at all, but many people believed it. By 1925, unemployment had reached 2 million. And the pressure downward on wages, because there were so many unemployed people ready to work, wages went down. And the miners' strike in 1926 against wage cuts developed into a general strike. Not the first general strike, there was one in the 1840s, but there are not often general strikes in Britain. The big general strike of 1926, which will have a huge influence on everybody, including the BBC. Now, the 1920s is sometimes characterised as the beginning of the jazz age. Charlie Chaplin was on at the cinema. Cinema was extremely, extremely popular. Jazz music was gaining in popularity. Dance halls were on the rise. Ordinary people, instead of sitting in the music hall and watching the show, they went to the dance halls to dance. And by the end of the decade, the arrival of the microphone on stage and the talkie movie, the movie which talks, transformed popular entertainment. Society was already changing. Families were getting smaller. 3 or 4 children was the most common. Tuberculosis and polio remained common in working class parts of town, as did whooping cough, diphtheria, scarlet fever. This is before vaccination. People have forgotten. So let's look then in this context. Now I've just given you the 1920s in 4 minutes, but you know, we would need a little bit of context. So let's look at the BBC. The 18th of October 1922 saw the formation of the British Broadcasting Company, and the first broadcast went out from London. But when they went out from London, you couldn't hear them all over the country, just in London. And the following day, there were broadcasts from Birmingham and Manchester. And in December, from Newcastle. And here you have the London transmitter. That's what it looked like. Would you like to have one of these in your house? Doesn't look very useful, does it? Yes, there's the transmitter. And in December 1922, so that is to say, 2 months after the foundation of the British Broadcasting Company, John Reith was hired to become the managing director. And John Reith, when he wrote in his autobiography, "I didn't even know what broadcasting was. I saw the advert and I came along, and to my surprise, I got the job." Now, one of the things about autobiographies is you have to be a little bit careful. People do change their story to help them, to make the story more entertaining or funny. And it seems that it's not exactly true that he didn't know what broadcasting was. But certainly he was not an expert. He was an engineer, and he mostly seemed to be hired because of his characters. And, oh, he looks like a serious chap. He worked hard in the war. This is the way that elite co-option worked at the time. Yeah, it was not. Give me your curriculum vitae and your letter of motivation. It was, oh, do you have any friends who might want a good job and pretty serious and well organized? Oh yes, I do. I'll phone him up. Yeah. So that's the way it all worked, and it was all completely new. And although it's not true that John Reith didn't know what broadcasting was, certainly this cartoon from the 1920s shows how surprised people could be about what radio was. So they're hearing all these new words, like radio was a new word, and wavelength, and so here there's a little joke about it. Well, they catch the waves and they measure their lengths. Yeah, of course they're talking about the waves of the sea, and they're just joking about this new word of wavelength. What could that be, wavelength? So the BBC was established as a commercial broadcasting company. Its objective was to make money. Also, to produce good programmes, because if you produce good programmes, more people will buy wirelesses. And the people who made up the broadcasting company were companies who made wirelesses, who made the radios. And they wanted to sell more and more of them. And so they thought, well, if we make good programmes, then that will do it. And so this was the idea. Yeah, it was a private company made to make money, like private companies do, which is perfectly honourable. However, they decided that they did not have advertising. They did not have advertisers, even when they were a private company. But they did sell, sometimes, they did sometimes have sponsored programmes paid for, particularly by British newspapers. So the Times, if they wanted, could buy half an hour in the evening for somebody to read short extracts from the Times. And advertise the Times. You need to read the Times. It's very good. And so on. And of course, this company lasted for a few years. So if we move out of 1922 and just have a little look at these statistics, you can see that you have an explosion in the number of wireless licenses. If you buy a wireless, a radio, then you had to pay a license when you bought it. It's like a tax, like a sales tax. And so you can see 35,000. Okay, it's not that many, really. 600,000 the next year. And suddenly, John Reith was the... suddenly people said, this is going to be really big. This is going to be really big. You know? And then, you know, 1 million, 1.6 million, 2 million, 2 million in 1926. Yeah, so in 4 years, we've gone from 35,000 to 2 million. Now, notice that 2 million is still very much a minority of the population. I'm not sure of the population. 35, 40 million, something like that. So it's still, but this is an absolute explosion. And I did put on the blog somewhere a 30-minute documentary about early radio broadcasting. I think I did anyway. And if I didn't, then I will do. I just put it in red so I can check. The radio license was established at the price of 10 shillings. Now, when you're looking at history and you're looking at prices, you need to know more than that, because 10 shillings, it's impossible for you to know how much money that is. So to help you, this is the price of 20 pints of beer at the time. Okay, a radio license cost the price of 20 pints of beer. Now, that is in fact more expensive than it sounds, because today we generally, I mean, an average person has more spare money than in the 1920s. So the amount, for many people in the 1920s, 80% of your income was rent and food. And so the spare money, there was not much spare money. So it's actually quite expensive for 10 shillings, the price of 20 pints of beer. And it attracted tremendous interest. And so here, for example, in London, in June 1922, you can see there is a wireless demonstration. You go to this big hall, and they will show you a radio receiving sound from a distance. This is in a tradition. There was a long tradition of scientific demonstrations on stage. That was a long tradition. And here they, I don't know if you've seen the film The Prestige. That's about this in the early 20th century. And so here you go. Speech and music will be sent out by Marconi's and several other stations and made audible to all. Short descriptions will be given by those who already possess wireless apparatus. And there will also be a large collection of different types of instruments. Admission, fivepence and ninepence. Demonstrating on actual broadcast systems. Would you like to hear about wireless from a woman's view? The evening will be spent in explaining the actions of wireless instruments briefly. So interesting things there. This is also a moment. Remember, in 1918, women over 30 have the vote. And so the whole idea that women need to be more educated, that women are going to be a bigger part of the public space, is quite in the air. Not everybody likes it, but it's not. Now, there'd been a long struggle for women's education. I remember in the 1870s or 1880s, they organised lectures on science in Liverpool only for women. Because all the powerful people said, well, women aren't interested in science. There's no point in letting women into university. And so the people who were in favour of women's education organised free lectures on science for women. And they got 2,000 women in and then 3,000 women in. And it was just a great demonstration because so many of the old-fashioned people were absolutely convinced women are not interested in science. You're wasting your time. Okay, and there you have a receiver from 1922. I don't know how to use it, I'm afraid. And here you have in 1923, then a call for capital. So, you know, would you like to buy shares? Yeah, I never bought a share in my life, but like one can do for commercial companies to make money. So you buy shares for £100 and you hope that the next year they will give you profit from it. So what was happening in on the airwaves then? What could you hear? Remember, of course, at this time, you have a couple of hours a day. Radio programmes, yeah. Oh, only a couple of hours a day. You know, it's not all day. They don't have the resources to do that. So it's a couple of hours a day. And in January, the British National Opera's... January 1923, the British National Opera Company's production of The Magic Flute was the first ever outside broadcast. Before that, everything had been done in the studio. For the first time, they had an outside broadcast, and this was The Magic Flute. And it was seen as an extremely exciting time for the people in it. They were discovering. It was a bit like, you know, you imagine the people who worked on the space race for the first, or the people who are working today on trying to get the first spaceships to Mars. And, you know, sometimes they're well paid, often they're not very well paid, but they're passionate about getting a spaceship to Mars. And it was really that atmosphere. In February, the wireless hit Cardiff, and in March, Glasgow. Yeah, and so it's going out around the UK little by little. And the very first sports reports came in March 1923 from the Derby. The Derby is an extremely well-known horse race once a year. And in September, the very first issue of the Radio Times, the official organ of the BBC. And inside, you have the programmes, the list of the programmes by every day. And also you have articles about the programmes. Sometimes amusing articles, often educational articles. It's quite a small thing. It costs 2p, the official programmes. And you can see something about it, yes? Yeah. Lord Gainford's message to listeners. Okay, Lord Gainford, was the president, yeah, not the director general, that was John Reith, but the president. Eckersley is an engineer, and he's writing on simultaneous broadcasting. But there's also gossip about artists. Yeah, so you've got a sort of popular side to it. Gossip about artists, the commérage people, si vous voulez. Now, what's wonderful about the Radio Times is today, this magazine still exists, and it's called the Radio Times. Now, of course, most people buy it for the television today, but it's still the Radio Times. Fascinatingly, for a very long time, it only had the BBC programmes. So in the 1970s, when I was very little, if you wanted to know what was on the television, you had to buy two magazines every week. The Radio Times for the BBC, and the TV Times for independent television, for private television. And, and for a long time, the BBC refused to print anybody else's programmes, but eventually they did sometime in the 80s. 1923 is also the year, just to remind you, I won't go back into the details, when the Sykes Report was published. So that's the Sykes Commission I have already spoken about, and which you, I'm hoping you're beginning to have some sort of link now. One of the things they began, thinking, so what can we do with the radio? What can we do? Now we've got the radio. What kind of programmes can we do? Well, a bit of sport, a bit of opera, okay. The news, we're not allowed to have that. They were only allowed to present the news once a day in the evening, after all the newspapers had been sold, because the newspapers were frightened of the competition and were quite powerful, so they didn't. There wasn't much news. So what can they do? Well, they decided to have talks. So this were like lectures, really, by experts. So it was like being able to be in university, even though you were in a small village or in Glasgow, or you were just an ordinary person. And one of the sets they set up was Talks for Women. Talks for Women. And the reason that you have Princess Alice here is that she was the first person to give the first talk on in the series Talks for Women. And it's fascinating that the subject that she gave it about, remember that, today in the 21st century, it's quite fashionable to be a feminist. At the time, it was really not fashionable to be a feminist. Her first talk was about the adoption of children, about adopting children. Why not? Now, they had to discover how to make the talks, because in fact, the radio is something new. If you're used to talking in a hall, 1,000 people, and you're talking to them, well, you have to talk like that, and that's how people did it. This doesn't work on the radio. Although you can't see them, you need to talk as if you have a small group of 3 or 4 people in front of you. Remember, for the public lectures in the halls, there are no microphones. In 1923, there's a microphone for the radio, but there's no microphones there's no amplification for halls, and so if you're singing in a big theatre, you just sing loud. So this Talks for Women were a massive success. In 1923, they had 150,000 listeners. In 1927, 9 million listeners. In 1939, 34 million listeners. So this is a major contribution to popular education and to women's education, and it really does transform people in the sort of way that the internet transformed. It really was a huge step going somewhere. Now, strangely enough, the BBC was quite a good place for women to work. In the early 20s, it was a very new industry, it was very avant-garde, and so it had a bit more progressive ideas than most places, so women managers were paid the same as men managers. Now, we consider that to be normal today, it was very exceptional at the time. And they gave 12 talks for women every week. Talks about electricity, talks about cooking. It has to be said, the speakers were not always paid. They were often experts from the elites come to talk to the women. Talks on poultry keeping chickens, beauty, tennis, dancing, bridge. Talks by Lady Emmet, who used to be a suffragist, and she spoke on how local government affects the home. So notice here, there's very, very interesting talks for women, how local government affects the home. So it's politics, local government. But women are supposed to be interested in politics because of the decisions made about family life. They're not supposed to be thinking about the decisions made about science or war. Yeah. But nevertheless, it is public space. And another lady, in the general sense, another woman gave a speech on women and public health. Yeah, how important women are in public health. So these early talks for women, they reflect an understanding of an audience who had time for leisure and were grappling with the notion of citizenship. Although they are fairly clearly for an audience of middle class women. This is unsurprising for a number of reasons. First of all, if there are, over the 20s, 1 or 2 million radios, then it's going to be the middle class, isn't it? Because it does cost a little bit of money. One more example, this wonderful woman. This is Marion Cran, and she was the BBC's first celebrity gardener. She gave talks. She gave a series of talks called her gardening chats, and the first one was in August 1923. So this is very. First of all, strangely enough, I don't know. There's something about British culture here, but gardening has always been important on the radio in Britain. In fact, there's a very famous program, Gardener's Question Time, which has been on BBC Radio 4 for. Probably for 60 years, I don't know how long, but for many, many decades. And people come to ask expert gardeners, oh, can I tell you about the problems I have with my roses or tulips or whatever kind of things? So there's this gone. And Marion Cram was the first one. And again, you know, who has gardens in Britain in the 1920s? It's not so much the working class, although, interestingly enough, probably more urban working class in Britain have gardens than in France, because the tradition, you know, the tradition of the English houses. In fact, we often mock it a little bit. They're all identical with a little garden each, just a little one. But there, it's partly true, and so I think there was an interest here. However, some other topics such as hints for holidays. They gave a talk for women on hints for holidays. Well, hints for holidays is a talk for middle class women, because working class women were not going to go on holiday. So this talks for women then is very important example from the radio of the 20s about diversity, and also takes us away from the idea, of course, far fewer women went to work in the 20s than today. Nevertheless, you're talking about, instead of 80% of women at work today, you had maybe 20-25. So it was not unknown by any means. It was a real thing. Last example, they had quite a lot of women members of parliament to give these talks. There were, of course, a very small number of women members of parliament, 3 or 4, but they got them into talk, and so this has an importance. It's normalizing the idea that women should be in parliament. One of the decisions they had to make for the talks for women, which came to be known for a short while as Women's Hour, not to be confused with Woman's Hour, which is a later programme, decades later. One of the things they had to decide is, should these talks be domestic? Should it be mostly about, do we need to talk to women mostly about the home and their family? Is that what women want to hear? Or do women want to hear about things which are outside their world? Although it's impossible for us to know exactly, if you look at the letters they received, the BBC received hundreds of letters every day, or sometimes thousands of letters every day. And the impression when you read the letters, according to one scholar, is that there are lots of women writers saying, oh, don't tell me more about how to look after my children. I do that all the time. Tell me something else. Tell me something new. In 1928, for the first time, listeners' recipes were read out. Send in your recipes for good cooking, cheap cooking for the family, and we will read them out. And this was the first example of audience participation. They also got doctors in to talk about health and so on. And they occasionally attacked rather difficult questions. For example, they had a talk about stammering. Do you know the word stammering? Yes, stammering is a speech defect where you can't pronounce certain consonants. And this is a very, very interesting phenomenon, stammering. It used to be much more common. And that's because, it used to be much more common because it was just considered, he stammers, you know. Today, if you have a young teenager who stammers, then you think about it and you see a psychologist, and sometimes, and it very often helps. At the time, it's just, he's a boy who stammers, that's what he does, you know. But even I've noticed that, I'm not that old, but in the last 50 years, I used to hear people stammer quite a lot, 40 years ago. I mean, not hundreds, but, you know, it was, and it's less and less common. So there you go. That was something which I put in 1923 because it began then, but the talks for women went on longer. But I am going to move on to 1924, although I will regularly use the excuse of the year to say a little more. And I am recording the sound. Yeah, so you will get to have the sound if it's useful to you. It might be, or some people who couldn't get here, of course. So 1924, they were making money. They were making money. That was fine. The companies who were part of the British Broadcasting Company. The British Broadcasting Company was a federation of companies, and each of them had to give £10,000 to be part of the BBC. But it was okay. They seemed to be. It was making them sell a lot of wirelesses, and the machines were expensive. And so they were making that money. Now, people who didn't have so much money, they would make their own machine. It was quite common for people to make their own machine. It was very difficult to do, but, you know, people are. So what did they do? They began to do some new things, recording radio plays. Du théâtre pour radio. They had great difficulty with this because a lot of playwrights, remember the theatre was extremely important at the time, much, much bigger than today. Well, far, far bigger. And playwrights would write a script and send it to the BBC, but the BBC would get it and think, we can't do this on the radio, it won't work, people won't understand. And so, in fact, it was very difficult to train writers into writing for the radio. One very, very clever writer wrote two plays for the radio in the 20s, which were set in the dark. One of them was the story of people trapped in a coal mine and all the lights went out. And so he'd actually made it to fit. At this time, the stations, the broadcasters, were separate. There was no national broadcasting. There was Liverpool, Leeds, Hull, Newcastle, Glasgow. And in every town, they had a completely different idea about what to do with the programmes. So it was a very, very creative time because everybody was inventing how to do it. The first children's programmes were brought out in 1924-25. And they used to have every day the time signal direct from Paris, from the Eiffel Tower. You know, when you hear the ring, it is such and such a time. In 24 was the first ever theatre company specifically set up for radio. But they had a little bit of difficulties, of course, because they didn't have any. You know, today, if you make a play for radio, say, OK, we need an explosion. Get me one explosion, two thunderstorms and four doors closing, because you have a sound effects archive. But they didn't have any of that, so they had to make it all up. One of the people who was involved at the time talked about how they loved to work in broadcasting. This is what he said. All kinds of petty discomforts, overcrowded rooms, long hours, arbitrary or tactless treatment were overlooked in the general sense of adventure, progress and public service. You felt it was a privilege to be in at the birth of such a mighty experiment. An experiment not merely in the use of a new invention, broadcasting, but in its use for communal ends rather than for private profit. Now, as soon as the BBC was founded, the daily newspapers were very worried. They said, we're not going to sell any more newspapers. If we have news on the radio every hour, we'll not sell any more newspapers. And they were very powerful people. And so they insisted then to the Postmaster General, who's the government person in charge of all this, that the radio should not be allowed to present the news. And indeed, very quickly, there was an official agreement. The BBC could only have news bulletins in the evening after the last edition of the newspapers had been sold. And also, the BBC was not allowed to hire journalists. All they could do at the news bulletins was read articles from the newspaper. Interestingly enough, if I remember correctly, the very first news bulletin, they read it twice. They read it once very, very slowly so that you could take notes, and then they read it at a normal speed. A whole load of things which we take for granted today, were very, very different in the 1920s. For example, every interview was scripted. First of all, the radio presenter wrote the questions, and then the guest wrote the answers, and then they rehearsed it, and then they put it out on the radio. The idea of spontaneous interviews didn't exist. And this was not surprising, because people had only really read interviews in the newspapers. They'd never watched somebody being interviewed, and so they weren't expecting the same things. Indeed, only in 1935 did the BBC create a news department. There was no news department before 1935. And in 1935, when they opened the news department, they hired 5 journalists. It's not a lot. Only in the Second World War were the restrictions abandoned. And during in 1940, the BBC presented 10 news bulletins every day. But for the whole of the 20s and 30s, they were not allowed to. OK, so to stay with our chronology, 1925. Just a little picture of one of the radios you could buy in 1925, because they wanted it to appeal to the middle class. The middle class were the people who had the money for it. So they wanted it to appeal to the middle class. And so you saw the one from 1922. Well, it didn't look very pretty. And so what they did is they hear your cabinet work in any period, and you can choose, do you want Victorian style, or a Queen Anne style, or a Regency style, or a Louis XVI style? You can choose. Very expensive, of course. And the batteries and loudspeakers are hidden away. So it can be part of your very bourgeois living room, it's no problem. So fascinating. So this is interesting, because radio is not just about, and television indeed, is not just about giving out information and entertainment and so on. It's also about becoming part of people's lives, in this case, bourgeois people. Here's another example. £49. This is a lot of money. I can't remember the. So this is 500. Let's get this right. Now this is 100 times the cost of the license, and I already said that the license was 20 pints of beer. So this is 2,000 pints of beer. That sounds so. It's just like a man to measure things in the number of pints of beer. But then what can you do? So it is really very expensive. But this big money you're getting here. And in 1925, the Crawford Report comes out, which I've already talked about, the Crawford Committee. So I'm just recommending that instead of the British Broadcasting Company, which is okay, but really needs to be replaced by a public corporation, which is not a private company. In fact, as we shall see, really the British Broadcasting Company, although it did make some money, already had a public service view of what broadcasting should be. And so when they moved on the 1st of January 1927, it's no longer a company, it's a corporation. Nothing changed. The same people were in the charge of the different departments. John Reith continued as before. It was not a big overthrow. Now, 1926 is the year of the general strike, and this will be important in general. Well, first of all, it reminds us that this was unemployment was rising and wages were falling and people were desperate. Millions in May 1926, millions of workers went on strike in support of the miners, who were threatened with a wage cut and a lengthening of the working day. There were thousands of strikers fighting with the police, and the police were trying to get the trams working. Thousands of volunteers from social elites, for example, students from the University of Oxford, tried to replace workers by driving trains and so on. And more left-wing students, and I knew one of them. I mean, he's passed away now, but the father of a friend of mine who was very old, he remembers in 1926 he was 16 and he was one of the ones throwing coal at the Oxford students to make it harder for them to work. The general strike lasted for 9 days. This is a long general strike, in fact. It doesn't sound like a long time, 9 days. But it is when there's a general strike on. After 9 days, the Trade Union Congress called off the strike. In the absence of newspapers, the BBC produced 5 news bulletins a day. And here you have miners and railwaymen waiting to hear a news bulletin. Because there were no newspapers. That's not true. There were 2 newspapers. The government newspaper. I think Winston Churchill was the editor. It was only like one page or something. And the trade union newspaper. They also produced a trade union newspaper. So you can see people are on their way to hear the news bulletin. And they're very, very excited about them. Now, the crisis placed the BBC in a delicate position. This was a national crisis. It was very, very high temperature. And John Reith, he knew that if he was not careful, the government would simply commandeer the BBC and say, OK, all the managers, please go home. I'm the minister and I am deciding what is on the radio. And that's it. The government was taking it over in a national emergency. And John Reith did not really want to do this because he wanted to establish the BBC as an institution which had some independence. At the same time, he completely agreed with the government that the strike was a horrible thing and needed to be defeated. Of course, he was part of the elite. He wasn't going to support the strikers. And the government was divided. Some of the government said, "Yeah, we just need to take over the BBC. We want to control the BBC." And this was Winston Churchill's opinion. But the BBC and Lord Reith, he wasn't Lord Reith at the time, John Reith, was able to persuade the government, listen, if you take over the BBC, people will not take the BBC seriously because there's so much just the government's view. Leave it to us. It is more useful for the national interest and the government interest to have a BBC that presents some opinions from both sides, and so that we have a certain form of impartiality. Now, they weren't really impartial. For example, the BBC refused to allow a representative of the Labour Party to speak on the BBC. And there was another moment when there was a speech made by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the Church of England. They said, "Oh yes, well we'll broadcast your speech next week." So they certainly weren't really impartial, but they did show some opinions from each side. Gene Seaton, one of the historians who wrote about it, said John Reith invented modern propaganda in its British form. That is to say, propaganda which is much more intelligent than just giving one point of view, which nobody's going to believe if you just only give one point of view. So it is moulding the production, but in a way which maintains a certain amount of impartiality. In fact, the Prime Minister, when he made his speech about the strike, was actually broadcasting from Reith's house. Because they were friends, you know. It wasn't really complete independence. In any case, the BBC was seen by the government as being very, very, very useful. And after the general strike, they were happy that they had not taken over the BBC. And so on the 1st of January 1927, a royal charter came into effect, transforming the British Broadcasting Company into the British Broadcasting Corporation. And John Reith becomes the first Director General. He was the general manager of the company. And the story of broadcasting goes on. In January, the first live sports broadcast was a rugby match. And in March, the BBC was provided with a coat of arms, which has not changed very much since. Now, normally at the time, you would have a coat of arms. When do you have a coat of arms and blazon? Well, aristocratic families have a coat of arms, although elite schools have a coat of arms, and army regiments also have a coat of arms. So the decision to have a coat of arms for the BBC is obviously linking the BBC to the elites. You know, we are like wonderful things, like the sections of the army and aristocratic families and so on and so forth. And they chose this slogan, "Nation shall speak peace unto nation." This slogan was changed, it's not a slogan, it's a motto, was changed in 1934. I'm not going to go into detail about analysing it. You can. You can see that you've got the world in the centre. And I don't know what... obviously every element is symbolic, but that's fairly easy to find on Wikipedia. Now, I think... I just want to say a couple of words about Hilda Matheson. I've already mentioned her. She was the lady who became the first director of talks in 1927. And she had a huge influence on wireless. And it is symbolic that though John Reith was, of course, a pretty conservative man in many ways, he believed in the empire. Nevertheless, he also believed in some women having a big role. And he actually went out to find her. I said, yeah, you're the person we want. Which in the 1920s, for a powerful man, was not so common, you know. It was not so common at all, yeah. In fact, there'd be many powerful men who would think, oh, well, you know, really, only men have interesting ideas. And so from that point of view, he was relatively progressive. So Matheson, what did she do? Well, first of all, she knew a lot of people. Her lover was a woman, Vita Sackville-West, who was an important literary figure. And she knew all the artists and critics and writers of the Bloomsbury Book. The Bloomsbury Group. So she knew H.G. Wells and Virginia Woolf and Julian Huxley. She knew these people and she got them in to give talks. And so that was one of the noticeable things about the 20s. And in 27 also, a previous tradition of classical music concerts, the proms, that's the promenade concerts. There was a tradition since the end of the 19th century of having promenade concerts for, I don't know, I suppose there must be about 20 or 30 concerts, perhaps a little more, over a season. And these were very popular among the bourgeoisie and the middle classes, yeah. And the BBC decided to take over the organisation, and they then became the BBC Proms. And this was partly a question of prestige. You know, now the BBC was not just broadcasting in general, they also had events which they were organising. They organised the BBC Proms, and you have at the top left a picture of the very first BBC Prom, 1927. And much later, and particularly after the Second World War, the BBC Proms became a rather unusual ritual, which is still the case today. At the bottom you have 2019. And what happens is that most of the proms are fairly normal concerts, you know, Mozart, Beethoven and so on. But the last night has become a tradition where they sing patriotic songs and wave flags and so on and make a lot of noise. Which is very unusual for classical music. Usually, if you go to see classical music, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut. If you go to see Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you are not supposed to sing along Freude, Schöne, Goethe, Funkentag. You're supposed to keep your mouth shut. So the proms is this kind of rather unusual thing. And also today, it's become really rather unusual because they sing imperialist songs, you know, wider still and wider may thy bounds be set. God, who made Britain mighty, may he make her mightier yet. You know, we want to take over the world, which is rather unusual today. Well, that's the BBC Proms. You can find out stuff about that quite easily. And in the same year, 1927, November 1927, Christopher Stone, who I don't have a photograph of, Christopher Stone became the first ever British disc jockey. He presented a record programme, which was announced as a gramophone recital. Yeah, un concert gramophone, where he played records. And this was something which was completely new. Now, the whole question of playing records has a long subsequent history on the BBC. And for a long time, it caused problems for the BBC because the musicians' union, the people who played the music, were very, very worried. They said, oh, if they play the records on the radio every day, nobody will buy any records because they can hear it all on the radio. And so they were the musicians' union, trade union, was quite powerful because concerts and so on were very important. And so they managed for a long time to establish a rule where there was a limit on how where the BBC had to pay a little bit for every time they played a record, and also that they could not do more than X hours a day of records. For a long, long time, that was the case, for decades and decades. And this had an important effect. 1928, women got the votes. And that is a moment, perhaps, to say something else about the BBC and women. John Rees said, women were as suitable for promotion as men were. And he also said, there is no reason that a woman should not be station director. Remember, the local stations had directors. So the BBC in the 20s was relatively progressive about women. Equal pay, equal promotion prospects. And also in the 1920s, the BBC did not have a marriage bar. A marriage bar means you can be employed when you're single, but if you get married, you are expected to resign. This was not unusual in schools, in the civil service, in insurance, in banking. This was the normal thing. Yeah, women would start work at 15 in a bank. And when they got married at 26, that was about average, they were almost compelled to resign. There are occasional exceptions. They were almost compelled to resign. This was called the marriage bar. And this was about the idea, which was widely accepted by men and by women, that the job of a married woman was to be at home and to look after the family. Now, one of the reasons for this, I mean, there were many reasons for this, but one of the reasons for it is that bringing up a family and looking after a home was much, much, much more difficult. If you have no vacuum cleaner, no fridge, no supermarket, no ready meals, no detergent, yeah, even modern materials, housework was just much, much, much more difficult. And one of the big problems they had is that every week on Wednesdays in the north, you go to the schools, and on Wednesdays there were no girls in the school because they were all helping their mother because it was washing day. Yeah. That was one of the justifications, that women were less keen to go to work because they had this huge responsibility of very long hours at housework. Well, thank you very much for listening. I almost got to the end of the 1920s. It took a little longer than I expected. But again, I'm hoping that you're always thinking, how does this event or this example, how does this fit to one of the big questions? Because I think you're going to get a big question. Your last time to write a question onto the chat, if you have a question to write onto the chat. There will be more videos, but not tomorrow. I have one of my doctoral students is going to become a doctor on Friday, so I can't do anything else before then. But this weekend there should be another video. And next week our class is at 5 o'clock. I don't have any choice about this. I know it's not a good time, but I have no choice about this. I've been made to go to important meetings about reorganising the university and stuff like that. But however, if you're not there, you will get at least the sound and the PowerPoint.